Let's continue. Tonight is the last. We're going to finish the David and Goliath section tonight. And with this, we wrap up this section of Shmuel Aleph, hopefully starting the next year, God willing, with the continuation. And by the way, we should just feel proud. I mean, I'm just looking back on what we covered this year. We really covered an incredible amount of material. I'm going to send out an email, hopefully, all the material that we covered over the year. It's just, it's been a tremendous amount of learning through the texts, through the Mefarshim, and we really, it's fabulous to see what we did together. So here, let's finish this up. What we have left is the actual battle and the retrospect of the battle. Okay, so we have what actually happens on the battlefield between David and Goliath, and how people review it afterwards. So we're going to do a few tiers of review. Let's deal with the battle itself first. So here we go. Let's return to our battle, and it starts in Pasuk Mem Ches. Okay, so we're going to start in the text of Pasuk Mem Ches 48, which is to be found if you're looking in the booklets on page 3, at the very, very bottom. Well, under the dark line, we're going to start and just read through the battle and see what happens over here. This takes us to the end of the parak. Okay? Almost to the end of the parak. Vaya im kom ha plishti vayelech vayikrav likras vaya ki kom ha plishti vayelech likras David vayamaher David vayorot samaracha likras ha plishti. The Philistine gets up, he starts walking towards David. David's there on the battlefield. David runs to meet him. So there's a collision, an imminent collision. Vayishlach David es yodoy el hakeli vayekach misham even vayekala vayaches ha plishti al mitzchoy vatitpah ha even mitzchoy vayipol aponov arza. David takes, as he's running, he takes a stone and he puts it into the sling and he slings it and it hits the Goliath in the forehead and sinks into his forehead and he falls down face forward into the field. Vayechezak David mina plishti bakele vaeven vayachez aplishti vaymiseyu vecherev ein biyad David. And David arrives and with the stone he kills him. And there was no sword in the hand of David. Vayaratz David vayamod el haplishti vayikach es charboi vayishlefo mita'aro vaymosesehu. Then David takes out the sword of... He doesn't have a sword, so whose sword? He takes Goliath's sword, takes out and he kills him. Now, if you're counting, that means to say he killed him twice. We just got to work out what that really means. You know, generally you can only kill a person one time within one lifetime. So vayichras bois roshoi, and he severs his head. Vayiru haplishtim kimes giboram vayonusu. And the Philistines, seeing that their power man has been killed, now flee. Vayakumu anshei Yisrael v'Yehuda vayareu vayirdufu el es haplishtim ad boacha gai v'ad shari ekron vayiplu chalalei haplishtim b'derek sharaim v'ad gas ad ekron. And the Philistines run, the Israelites chase them, there's lots of battle and corpses lying along the way. Vayashuvu b'nei Yisrael mitzloik achar ha-plishtim, vayashasu es machanehem. Then they return, and now they can ransack the camps, which have been abandoned in fleeing. Vayikach David es rosh ha-plishti, vayivyeu Yerushalayim, ves keilov som bo'aloi. He brings the head to Jerusalem, and he takes all the things that he was wearing, and he brings them to his tent. Wow, that was quite a battle, right? So there's a few things to understand over here. How did he die? You're right, cause of death. The fire department now comes and they have to deal with the remains. Cause of death was? Okay, so the psukim make it pretty clear that he died, not because of the first rock, it sounds like, right? Sounds like when he arrived there, he killed him with the second rock. Right? It sounds like there was a sling, hits him in the forehead, he falls down, he takes another rock, and he kills him. That's what the Mephoreshim suggests. This is very important, because the psukim seem to be indicating that the death wasn't by a weapon. It wasn't by a regular, conventional weapon. It was by a stone. And he used the sword simply to, whether it means to say, to stop the rigor mortis, or to just to sort of finish, meaning he's a dead man, but sort of just to finish the process up. That's what the sword is used for, interestingly enough. What the Mephoreshim, most of the Mephoreshim suggest over here. Now, the interesting thing about this is, at this point in time, is where is the encampment of the Jews, of the Israelites? Where are they at this point in time? They're on top of the mountain. They're overlooking what's called the Valley of Elah. Now, that is not Jerusalem. Right? That's not Jerusalem. So it sounds like David HaMelech is now arriving in Jerusalem with his head. What's going on over here? Why is he suddenly in Jerusalem with his head? The Radak suggests over here an interesting suggestion. Let's take a look at, if we can just flip to the back of our booklets. The Radak over here has an intriguing idea. It says in Source 21. He says, Vayevi'ehu Yerushalayim. He brings the heads to Jerusalem. Achar shehevi'u lifnei Sha'ul. Of course he must have returned to the Israelite camp first to show it to Sha'ul, because after all that's his commanding officer. He says, Kumo shekos v'rosha plishti biyadoi, as we're going to see in a second. V'achar koch hevi'u biyadoi ba'orei Yisrael levaser hanashim v'ataf. Then he took it, he took the severed head, and he went from city to city to show everybody what had occurred. V'oysom shalayu b'milchama ad shehevi'u ad Yerushalayim. Until he brought it to Jerusalem, which is ultimately going to be the capital, which he's going to make of Jerusalem. So what's going on over here, says the Radak? Jerusalem was the ultimate destination of this. Why? Because this was a victory parade. Remember David HaMelech said, you cursed the living, we'll call it, systems of our God. Well, I'm going to publicize very clearly and incandescently that this, in fact, is the response. This is what happens when you do this. I'm going to walk around with your head to make sure that everybody knows that your curses, that mouth, is now severed from the body. So that's what David HaMelech is trying to achieve. It's the final reparations. That's what the Radak says over here, which is interesting because we'll deal with the last shot a little bit later. Yes, Lynn.
Well, the only question is, at this point in this history, though, Yerushalayim doesn't mean anything.
You're right. It's
so
a very interesting
sure
point.
I'm not sure why this has anything, meaning David is the one who finds the Makom Mashiach Yechar, and he's the one who captures Yerushalayim from Yuvasim.
You're right.
So now has no answers. I don't even know what this is.
You're right. So I was also bothered by that great question, which is that Jerusalem is not yet owned by, on the whole, by Israelites. And in fact, David's going to be the one to conquer and buy it later on. At the end of Shmuel, which lays the framework for Shlomo HaMelech's building of the Beis HaMikdash. But now it isn't necessarily something. So I want to just, the only thing is it's a complex history, in the sense that, not complex in the way that UNESCO thinks of it. We're at a point in history where UNESCO doesn't have has historical reach at this point in time. They're not able to fathom the fact that there was a history before Palestinians. So, but at this point in time, there is a complex history to Jerusalem, and that is that it sounds like there were many attempts for the conquest of Jerusalem. In the book of Yehoshua, there's an attempt. In the book of Shoftim, there's an attempt. And it sounds like the Yevusi, the Jebusites, who are the nation who live in the suburbia of Jerusalem are a very strong nation indeed, and they manage to withstand attacks till later on when David HaMelech attacks it and later on buys the area of the Beis HaMikdash. So they're very strong and hard, manage to hold on to this particular area. But it does sound like, for whatever reason, that Tanakh tells us how many times they attacked it, they knew that there was something special about it. And the Mepharshim debate, maybe they captured certain areas, meaning maybe they had West Jerusalem and the Jebusites had East Jerusalem until David fully vanquished it. But I wonder if the fact that there was numerous conquests is an indicator that they already knew there was something special, just they weren't able to fully access it until David HaMelech fully conquered it. So that's, you know, it does sound like there's a stage of conquest of Jerusalem for the fact that Tanakh mentions so many times. So I wonder about that, and maybe this is David HaMelech's telling everybody this is special. He ends the victory parade there. Maybe, we don't know. There's a lot of things that could be happening over here. What is just interesting is that we're going to see that as we go on in Shoftim, so in Shmuel, we're going to see that Shaul HaMelech is going to be very upset by the way that David is paraded in the streets. He feels that David is getting undue or overdue respect for what he did. And David is doing this is almost a very flagrant, you know, victory parade, which is, why is David doing this? Because, what's he upholding?
Hashem.
He's upholding the honor of God, of Hashem. But what does Shaul see? Shaul sees it as upholding of the honor of David. Right, so that's the danger that we have over here when dealing with these difficult situations of, you know, very big officers of power. David HaMelech is really doing the right thing, but at the same time, it becomes dangerous because of the way it's going to be viewed. Well, for later when we get into the next parak. In the meantime, now as this is happening, at this point in time, if this is where the parak ended, we would say, you know, is this great, good, neutral? This is fabulous, right? This is off the charts amazing. Everything worked out. What did the people in Tanakh think about it? So before, you know, before I ask ourselves, let's say, what do the people living then think about this? So we have mixed reviews, interestingly enough. In the last four psukim of this parak, Nun Hei to Nun Ches, we have a response over here. Here we go. And this now is the seeds for further understanding of what's going on. Return to the psukim, the very top of page 4, Nun Hei to Nun Ches, the last section now. Uvechiros Shaul es David yotzeli kras haplishti. As Saul, as Shaul watches David walking out to the plishti, and remember, David HaMelech is not wearing the armor. He doesn't think he needs armor, he doesn't think he needs a sword. He's walking out very, very strongly, very, very courageously to this Philistine. Omar el Avner sar hatzava, ben mizeh hanar Avner. Avner, tell me something. Who's this fellow? Who's this guy who's walking out there like that? Vayomer Avner, chay nafshecha HaMelech im yodati. He says, Avner says, you know, I really, you know, by your life, I don't know. He makes an oath. I don't know who this is. Vayomer HaMelech, sha'al ata ben mi zeh ha'elem. Please ask whose son he is. V'cheshuv David me'akos es ha'plishti. V'aykach azor Avner v'yevayel lifnei sha'ol v'rosh ha'plishti b'yadai. As he returns to the battlefield, Avner quickly pulls him into the king's tent, and there he is holding on to Goliath's head, which, by the way, is probably a very heavy article. So he nonetheless brings him in. Vayomer elav Shaul ben mi ato anar, whose son are you? Vayomer David ben Avdecha Yishai Beis Halachvi. I am the son of Yishai Jesse of Beis Lechem. Now, if you're raising eyebrows because this sounds a little strange, you're right, because this is a little strange. Why is this strange?
Shmuel anointed him as king beforehand.
So wait a second, Shmuel knows that. Shaul's asking, yeah. Okay. Right, so Shaul, but does Shaul know him? The answer is, yes. Why should Shaul know him? Because he plays for him. He's one of the musicians in his hall. Why is he asking who he is? Well, is he actually asking who he is? What's he asking?
His lineage.
He's asking his lineage, right? So what's going on over here? Why is Shaul so interested suddenly? Yes.
Interestingly enough,
over here, it sounds like maybe what's going on is that when he sees somebody who's acting in such a strong way, in such a role of leadership, then the Shaul internal senses, which sound code red, this could be a potential king, goes off, right? Because there's something, Shaul knows he's been deposed of spiritually. He knows there's going to be somebody who's going to replace him. He doesn't know who that person is. Now suddenly, in walks this young red man, right? Who suddenly wants to go out to the battlefield without even as much as armor or a basic weapon on him. And he walks out and he says, you know, I'm just scratching my head. That sounds a little strange. Where does he come from? Right? So there's a threat which is being described over here. The way Rashi puts it, if we take a look in source 24, Rashi recounts an interesting piece of Talmud of Gemara which describes exactly this conversation. He says, at the beginning of the source, V'chi loy haya makira, says Rashi, did he not know who he was? V'haloy kasiv, is it not written? V'yayaveu ma'oid, he loved him. V'yiloy kenose kelov, he wasn't just his musician, in fact, he was his arms bearer. Somebody you trust to the nth degree. So he says, Ela ra'eu misnaheg betachsisei malchus. He saw him acting in a way which looks a little too royal for just a boy. Omar Shaul, imbomi mishpachas b'nei Peretz, melech yeh. If he comes from the family of Peretz, who was Peretz? Peretz was the son of Yehuda. If he comes, he was the firstborn of Yehuda and Tamar. If he comes from that lineage, I know that Shamelech Poretz Gerer Asos Loiderech Ve'ein Memachin B'Yodai. If he comes from Peretz, Peretz was the child who pushed Zerach out. There were twins. He pushed aside his twin brother to come out. Then he says, "Oh, there's something dangerous over here," because this is what kings do. They don't stop at anything. Ve'im Mishpachas Zerach Bo Choshuv Yehiya. If he comes from his younger twin brother who tried to get out and then had the red thread on his hand and was pushed back in, then okay, he'll be an important person, but not a royal person. Okay? So that's what the question he's asking. The Rashi continues without doing it inside here, but the Rashi says that at this point in time, Avner says, I don't know. Meaning Avner, in a certain sense, cloaks David's identity. Right? In a certain sense, saving him. And who enters the fray is Doeg HaAdami. That we've met him before, and you're going to see him many times later over here, that this another advisor to Shaul enters. Now this is, again, this is subtext. The text is not telling us about the story here. Chazal are filling us in with a tradition of the conversation that happens behind the words over here to make this conversation coherent. Right? So he's asking, whose son is this? Avner is cloaking the David's lineage because he's obviously protecting David. And Doeg says, where, before asking if he is fitting to be a king, ask if he's even Jewish. Is he even part of the tribe? Why would he question David HaMelech's Jewishness, his state of lineage? Because David comes from Rus. Says Doeg HaAdami, the last time I read the Torah, it says that anybody can become part of Judaism except for a few nations. And on the short list, I actually have it here, I PDF'd it right for you here, Shaul, I noticed that second from the top is the nation of Ammon. Now that creates a little bit of a problem. You worried about him being a king? Don't even think about being a king. He doesn't even have a Tudat Zehut. Right? He doesn't. He's not even Israelite. So then at this point in time, a argument erupts in the tent of Shaul. And some people say, but yes, the Torah does say that. But the last time we saw that PDF, there was an asterisk next to the word Ammon, and it said Ammoni for long. Ammonit. Only the men were actually prohibited from joining, but the women were not. And they start debating, well, why was that? Because the Ammonites, remember, they did not come and welcome the Israelites in the desert, but were the women involved? Were the women not involved? Right, so there's a whole long discussion, and finally, at the end of the whole discussion, it talks about how Asael comes in. I think it's Amosah comes in and says, I have a Kabbalah, I have a tradition from the Beis Din of Shmuel that it's Ammoni, but not Ammonit. It's only the men who are precluded. Rut was a woman. She was allowed to enter the fold, and he has clean lineage. So there's this whole debate which is erupting. What is the focus of this whole debate? Why is this so important? What's at stake over here?
Him being a king.
So you can say what has happened now is, up till now, the conversation has been Shaul's bad moods, his ruach ra. Up to now, the whole discussion has been, you know, the Philistines. Now the conversation has become, is David the king? And now that changes, that's going to change the tone of the next few chapters. Because now that this question has been asked, and there's been a debate as to how much he is part of the game and part of the future plan, that's what now changes what's the way that Shaul is going to interact with him, his family is going to interact with him, and Israel is going to interact with him. This is the one this question has been asked, which is essentially the implicit question asked after this. Why did it take this to ask the question? Why did it take this perek? What was special about now?
Now he's a shining star.
This is the first time he displayed publicly how powerful he was, in the absence of Shaul doing what he should have. Remember, Shaul was the person who should have been picking up the gauntlet. Who picked up the gauntlet? This young boy. Isn't that interesting? So here we have the turnaround, and where Shaul now, the threat to Shaul has now, instead of decreasing, has increased. And that's now going to open up the tone for the next chapters. What's interesting to note as well, the Meforshim do point out as well, is that, you know, we could say on a more derech hapshat, without this additional subtext, you could just say the Ralbag says, like, you know, well, in the end of the day, he didn't know the names of every single one of his courtiers. He probably said he wished them a good morning every morning when he walked in. He didn't know all his everybody by name. You know, he could have, you know, that was the guy who cleans his shoes, and that's the guy who, you know, who puts the water in the pitcher. But he doesn't know, you know, all their name by name. That's why he's asking. So it could have been, you know, very al derech hapshat. Some others say, well, the reason why he wants to know his family is because Shaul put a very high price tag on winning that battle. What was the price tag? His daughter's hands in marriage. So what's the first thing he says? Wait a second. Where do you come from, young man? Can I see your family tree, please? So what the Radak says is, like, he's a little more concerned of, yeah, not for the, we don't have to import necessarily the whole big picture of Malchus. We could just say, well, there's a more of a pressing issue at hand, and that is the future wedding date. Right? So she's going to get married. The question is, you know, who? And so the question is going to be, is David the right man? So that we could there are multiple tiers of level of meaning over here. So this is the perek, really, and of course each tier we talk about over here is what we've been seeing through the perek. There's the regular level of interaction which is going on, and then there's the more profound level of interaction, which is whether they're consciously or subconsciously experiencing that. But there seems to be a bigger question at hand throughout the parak. Now, let's delve a little deeper into the bigger picture over here. So we looked at the way Shaul responds to this incident. But how does history respond to this incident as a whole? So it happens to be, I was reading recently, because of the fact that we had the opportunity of doing this section, there's a book called David and Goliath. And you would never guess, but it's actually about this section of Tanakh called David and Goliath. So it's perfect. So it's one of Malcolm Gladwell's more recent books. After he wrote Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, and it's about the underdog, really. Essentially, the subtitle is Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. And as Malcolm Gladwell, as a journalist, does very well, he makes a very specific and simple argument. And he expresses that argument as in particular spheres, and gives you numerous examples in each sphere of how that argument plays itself out. So there's really two arguments in the back of this book: is how do we view power, and is it better to be a more or less powerful, small fish in a big pond, or big fish in a small pond? And he explores these ideas. But the platform on which he builds the book is our story. And his way of reading the story is very interesting. He says, he makes an argument which is the following. In those days, they used to have three types of soldiers. They had heavy infantry, so that would be somebody who wears regular armor, bears a sword or a spear. Then you have cavalry, so you have either, you know, if somebody is riding a horse or riding a chariot, light or heavy. And then you'd have slingers, which would later develop into obviously archers, right? So the slingers would have the advantage of slinging from afar. And he describes it very sort of almost simplistically, that each one, it was like rock, paper, scissors, had an advantage over the other one. So infantry was, let's see how he does this. Infantry had an advantage over horsemen, because they could use their spears to impale any incoming horsemen. Whereas the horsemen had an advantage over slingers, because slingers could not aim sufficiently to a moving object approaching them so fast. And the slingers had an advantage over infantry because they could stand from afar and be out of range of the infantry weapons like swords and spears. So that's the basic triangle that he draws. And then he goes to a long description of how a person who's really an excellent expert slinger has the ability of being able to hit objects at hundreds of feet away on a very precise point, and talks about the speeds in which a person is able to sling. So he talks about, I think something ridiculous, that 35 meters per second, you know, for some of these really expert slingers. So the argument he makes is that, who is really the powerful person here? Here you have Goliath in his thousands of armor, thousands of shekel weight armor. He is impervious. He's heavy infantry, right? He has a sword. He has a spear. He has a shield bearer. He has armor in every inch of his body, essentially. And here he is. He is, any regular infantry or cavalry is dead meat when they come out to him. But when he faces the nemesis of infantry, which is a slingshot, then actually, who is the person who is at the advantage? The slinger himself, because he is too slow moving, and he's not, and the slinger can stay out of range while having full access to him. So the way he puts it in this is on page 10 of the new booklets, in the first source, that he says, he quotes, twice David's mention of, actually let's do the second paragraph, he says, Goliath had as much chance against David, said historian Robert Dorenwend, writes, as any Bronze Age warrior with a sword would have against an opponent with armed with a .45 automatic pistol. Meaning basically, Goliath was a goner. So we think of it as, oh wow, look how powerful Goliath was, and look what David managed to do. No! The slinger himself was more powerful because he could move around, and we saw how cumbersome it was for Goliath to move. He wasn't able to move, so he stood no chance against David the slinger. So then you're going to ask the obvious question. If Goliath stood no chance against him, Does it sound like Goliath thinks that? No, Goliath is telling him, you know, come and I'll feed your flesh to the animals of the fields, right? So Goliath seems to think that he's got a pretty, you know, good chance in this battle. So why did Goliath not realize the immediate threat, argues Malcolm Gladwell? Well, he goes into a long medical description and he says the following. In the next thing, this actually is about 5 pages long, this section, but I'm just summarizing here. In the next paragraph, what many medical experts now believe, in fact, is that Goliath had a serious medical condition. He looks and sounds like someone suffering from what is called acromegaly, a disease caused by a benign tumor of the pituitary gland. The tumor causes an overproduction of human growth hormone, which would explain Goliath's extraordinary height. And he gives an example in the parentheses. And furthermore, one of the common side effects of the acromegaly is a vision problems. Pituitary tumors can grow to the point where they can compress the nerves leading to the eyes, with the result that people with acromegaly often suffer from severely restricted sight and diplopia, or double vision. Why was Goliath led onto the valley floor by an attendant? Because the attendant was his visual guide. Why does he move so slowly? Because the world around him is a blur. Why does it take him so long to understand that David has changed the rules? Because he doesn't see David until David is up close. Come to me that I may give your flesh to the birds and the heavens and the beast of the field, he shouts out. And in that request, there is a hint of his vulnerability. I need you to come to me because I cannot locate you otherwise. And then, in the otherwise inexplicable, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? David had only one stick. Goliath saw 2 sticks. So he has this whole long explanation where really Goliath was the victim over here. But he didn't realize he was the victim because he was suffering from a medical condition, which is the same source as his height, which also impeded his vision. Which is why over here he walked into his imminent death by calling David to fight with him. Because if a regular infantry would have realized that in fact he was up against a slinger, he would never have invited him into battle. And that's Malcolm Gladwell goes into a whole long description about understanding why maybe we sometimes misunderstand power and how it's wielded. Why, although some of these comments are well-founded, why is it that he couldn't be more wrong? This is why journalists should stick to journalism, not Tanaki. I mean, keep the rest of the book. It's fantastic. Make all the other arguments based on evidence you have. But maybe leave the Tanakh to the experts. So why is he wrong over here? What tells us that he is incorrect in his reading of this over here? Yeah.
There's no
Hashem
in the picture. Yeah.
Okay, so you're right. So God is certainly not part of his picture. You're right. that is true. You're right, so we're going to see how that, but I'm saying that's going to be a hard argument for the person on the outside to see. Do you know what I'm saying? You say, we know that. But how can we say, well, Malcolm, what about God? He said, well, God, you know, I don't know. So I want to know why is it impossible for this text to be telling the story that he's telling? Yes, Jesse.
Well, he was just kind of like bumbling around, like he's big, but, you know, blind and can't get around with anyone. Why would everyone be intimidated by him?
Okay, yeah. So number one is, it sounds like people are pretty terrified. If they knew that, oh, we just pull out the slingers, he's a dead duck, then why were they all running, right? It sounds like they were really scared of him, right? It sounds like people were in terror of this person. Now, what he argues, by the way, just in addressing that question, is he says because they had a misunderstanding of what strength was, meaning they thought conventional battle, and therefore infantry you send infantry to, and they were stuck within what Shaul was caught in. So David HaMelech broke out to unconventional warfare for a face-off in a different way, which has allowed him in. Right? So that's the kind of direction he goes in responding to that. But let's do it this way. Is not having a sword, in this case, a disadvantage or an advantage? Meaning what he's saying, according to Malcolm Gladwell, not having a sword, not being in infantry, is that an advantage or a disadvantage? It's an advantage, right? Because now you're now a slinger. You're not infantry. You don't have a small reach. You don't have to be limited to the battlefield. You're in more dangerous, right? So you would expect, therefore, the tone of the parak to say that although he thought that he was so powerful because he had a sword, but David, he was even more powerful. Is that the tone of the parak?
No.
Not at all. We have to read the tone of what's going on over here. David HaMelech does not think over here that he has the upper hand. That's clearly not happening. It may be true that he did go, he stepped out of conventional battle, but Goliath is not a dead duck in this business. Here's an example. Take a look at the son of the Psukim, which indicate this. We read these just in the last few weeks. Source 1 on the top of the next page, on page 11. If you flip to the top over here. And listen to the tone of the parak. Vayomet David el Aplishti. The David says to the Philistine, Atah bo elai becherev v'chanis v'chidon. You come to me with all these arms. Uvonochi bo elecha b'shem Hashem tzvokos. What do I come with you? I come to you with the name of God. He doesn't mention the slingshot. Right? Baruchos Yisrael, Ashecha Cherafta, who you cursed. He's not saying, I've got this special weapon. David HaMelech is saying, I'm bedafka. Remember when he took off those clothes because he didn't want to wear any armor? David's saying, I'm not. I'm completely vulnerable to you. That's why I'm simply coming to you with the smallest of weapons. Nothing that's going to be consequential. And then a few psukim later, in Pasuk Nun, he says, Vayechazak David minayis haplishti bekele ha'aven, Vayechaz haplishti v'amiseu, v'cherev ein biyad David. The psukim tell us, he killed him without a sword. Well, if a slinger is more deadly to an infantry than a swordsman, then that's not the point of the parak. The parak should say, ha-ha, he didn't know, he had a slingshot. Now, what a silly guy, he should have checked his pockets. Right, but that's not what the psukim say. The psukim say, he didn't even have a sword. There was no match. He wasn't in the same class of weaponry, Susan.
He wasn't even a soldier.
He wasn't even a soldier. Right.
Were there slingers? Is that like a...
Yes. So we do see there were slingers. Yes. Okay. So we're going to see, actually, I want to come back to in a moment. There were slingers in those days, and we're going to see where they were and how Tanakh grades them in terms of power in a second. Okay, so if we read the tone of the whole thing, it sounds like David HaMelech over here is attacking when he knows the odds are down. He knows this is he's no match for the man. It's not like he's coming out there with his secret weapon, which if anybody else knew, you know, it would impoverish Goliath. Because then it comes back to Jesse's point, then they should have sent a bunch of Davids long before. Okay, the Mepharshim also indicate this. Take a look at the Mepharshim. Source 3, this is the Metzudas David. He says, Vayechazek, he was strong in Pasuk Nun. David became strong. Nisgaber al plishti hamazuyan, v'loy v'yodo ki'im hakelev ha'even. He overcame this incredibly powerful Philistine, and all he had in his hand was Nebach, a slingshot. Right? So what's in the gradation of power over here? The sword, right? The slingshot is no match for the Iron Age instrument from a predating age weapon. The Ralbag in source 4, the Ralbag on Pasuk Mem. Ukfar his parsem bo zeh ha-pirsum me'oitzem nifla'ois Hashem shenitzach nar echad b'loi chere v'chanis. Look, you have this young boy, a shepherd boy, without any form of weaponry, overcomes the gibor kegoliot, who are gavoy arazim, gavoyim oitzem kli milcham toy. Goliath wasn't a dead duck in the way the Mepharshim and tradition looks at this. He was certainly nothing close to that. He was a very dangerous person, even to a slinger. That's the way that the Mepharshim are looking at this. Another example, the Malbim says in source 5, Vayishlach, he sent him out in Pasuk Mem Tes, V'nilvu alecha ashkochas Hashem, im bamesha kola lematora pam rishon. Was David going to hit the first time? Im bamesha kiven al mitzchoy, was he going to really hit his forehead? Was that a given? If he was going to fall, he might have fallen backwards. The fact that everything lined up just perfectly, that was very good luck or hashkacha, that it worked out. What the Malbim is saying is, don't think for a moment over here that David had the upper hand. He certainly did not. He had the upper hand because Hashem helped him, but not because he was by nature a more powerful soldier, which is what Malcolm Gladwell is arguing, but he sort of hid the card, so Goliath couldn't really see it yet. More importantly, earlier on, we're not going to read this inside, but a number of months ago, we learned a section where the Philistines and the Israelites first battled. And we found at that point in time that Israel was a tax-paying nation to the Philistine state on the banks, on the sea banks, or the Mediterranean Sea. And one of the restrictions that Israel had to live with was a weapons embargo. That means to say they couldn't produce any weapons. They weren't even allowed to have hoes for regular plowing. And they had no weapons except for one sword which Shaul had and one sword which Yonatan had. And the Radak, Rav David Kimchi, says, does it make sense? Didn't they fight a few battles beforehand? How could they fight wars if they didn't have any weapons? So he says, you know what? They were allowed to keep their retrograde slingshots. That's all they had, says the Radak. Meaning, what were the nation? What was the armament capacities of these different nations? Israel had all their heavy armory taken, and they were allowed, maybe, you know, they could smuggle in 2 swords for their whole population. The rest of the time, they had their socks and stones from the riverbank. That's all they had. Right? Well, if the slingers were so powerful in those days, then, well, what the Philistines should have restricted them to, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so in the end of the day, the way that the picture that's being drawn over here is not the triangle of each one being more powerful than the other, right? In the end of the day, it's been described as that there's advanced technology and there's less advanced technology. The advanced technology is swords, shields, armor, spears. And then there's also, you know, Nebuch, the backwards nations who don't have the QME, right? They don't have the qualitative military edge. And they just have Nebuch, stones and slings. And that's how they battle. And Israel, despite their handicap, beat them in the battle. That's what we learned in Perikud Gimel. That's what the Radak says explicitly. Which means to say that the more you read Tanakh, the more you read the tradition with which the Mepharshim were worked out and also carried from generation to generation, they understand that slings are a second-rate weapon. It's not that David had this incredible advantage. It's nice to put things in perspective, and it's true that David HaMelech certainly went out unconventionally, but he was in no way more powerful than Goliath to try to read history in retrospect. And this leads me to a Radak, which really pulls this whole issue to a beautiful close. This is in Source 7 on the bottom of page 11. The Radak says a fascinating, fascinating comment. He, like the archaeologists and the Bible scholars and the Malcolm Gladwells who pull this all together, because he's not saying this himself, he's quoting a number of scholars who say this, the Radak asks a practical question. And this is how it all starts, because we as human beings, we work within the confines of logic, and we say every effect must have a cause, right? So we work in our logic, you know, one A causes B. If we have a B, it must have been there was an A. Even though there could have been an A, C, D, E, F, and a Z as a cause for B. But nonetheless, once we have a B, we want to work out what the A is, because we've decided there's going to be one A. Right? So what happens over here is he asks the following very simple question. V'yesh sho'alim, heyach tovar evim mitzchay, v'ayala koveh rechoshes, ha'nechoshes ha'yal roshay, mechase mitzchay. Why, if David HaMelech was slinging, how did he even get to his forage? Weren't we told that Goliath was wearing this large helmet, this large copper helmet, to prevent slingers from slinging shots at their vulnerable spots, right? Meaning they're taken into account the fact that these retrograde Israelites have slingshots. He says, don't tell me that, you know, they left out the forehead. He has shin pads, for crying out loud, we're told about. You know, if he's going to guard his shins, he's going to guard his forehead, right? We can assume that the helmet is descending to the vulnerable parts of his face too. V'omrim, and the response that people give is, ki kasher omar ve'etznois b'sorcho lo'ofa shomayim, when he's laughing at David and he says, I will give your flesh to the birds of the heavens, what does he say he died to? He bit klape mala b'zichro lo'ofa shomayim. He looks upwards to peer at the birds of the heaven when he talks about the birds of prey. V'nishmat mashoya al mitzcho la'achore, and then the visor swings backwards, right? At such a point, v'oz kol David v'yikol al mitzcho, and boom! At that moment, David, seeing the vulnerability, the visor slips back, the stone goes in, and wonderful, everything is closed, right? That's a bit of a creative reading, right? So he says, I mean, like, so the Radak also thinks that's a little bit, bizarre drash. He says that's a little bit of an expansion, right? That's not explicit in the text, says the Radak. Bacharei, now he makes the point which is worthwhile for us to just absorb and really, really, really inculcate in our way of looking at Tanakh. Bacharei asher ho'esol milchames David ima plishti siba me'es Hashem. We understand, and this comes back to my mother's point, this is a battle between David and the Philistine, facilitated by none other than God. And the Pesukim tell us that David managed to get the stone into his forehead. Our question is not how. Stop asking logical questions, humans. Stop it. Don't ask how. Hashem worked it out. However it was, it worked out. Ve'efshar ki ha'even Avram again. Asher ha'mitzcha v'tova mitzcha. It could have been it slipped through, you know, there was a gap. You know, v'chein ame b'drash. Kevan shishle David ha'even b'barzel shal mitzcha. Nitpa mitzcha. It could have, like, you know, there could be a gap. It could have gone an angle. It could have been, you know, it was a sunny day. He looked up. There could have been a million things that why the stone went through and got to where it got to. V'ze'echad min ha'dvarim shishle da'kodesh baruch hu em esarach ba'kosher. What the takeaway is not the how A caused B. The takeaway is God made the small, the vulnerable, the less powerful win over the more powerful. That's the bottom line, folks. Right? So far from, and I think the Radak is really speaking to some of the modern philosophy of our, we'll call it revisionist history, and putting Goliath in the ophthalmologist's office. And saying that in the end of the day, we can find lots of very creative ways to read Tanakh. But in the end of the day, what's Tanakh telling us? Let's not get lost in the weeds. What's Tanakh telling us? Tanakh is telling us something very specific. And that is, weak will beat the powerful because Hashem wants them to win. That's what we're learning. That's the theme. That's the tone. And if your creative explanation is going to yield you an opposite result, then that can't have been what was happening, because Tanakh is telling us what happens. Right, we can't be cleverer than the way that Tanakh's telling it to us in the first place, because that's what Tanakh's trying to convey to us. That's the lesson we need to get. We can't try and sometimes be too smart to be able to read Tanakh in the way that Tanakh wanted it to be read itself. And with this, I'd like to close one last, a very, very fascinating idea. Going a little late, but I just want to finish one last very interesting point with which we'll close this section. And that is that there is an interesting point over here. That as much as we're told that David HaMelech does not have a sword, he's not taking a sword, he's not using a sword, he tells Goliath, I don't have a sword. And then Tanakh tells him, as he kills him, he doesn't even have a sword. Right? And Tanakh tells us all this. Nonetheless, at the end of the day, what does he do with the sword? He does use the sword, right? He pulls off Goliath's own sword and cuts off his head. Isn't that fascinating? Now, you're right, he didn't have any other instruments at this point in time to do this job. So he must have needed Goliath's sword. But it is interesting that later on, the sword does come up. And the Mepharshim talk about this, because later on we're going to see in Perek Chof Aleph, source 8, next page, we say that David HaMelech is running now from Shaul HaMelech. He's a refugee with hot pursuit, Shaul behind him. He arrives at Nov, the city of Kohanim, and he says, Vayomer David ala Achimelech. He turns to Achimelech of the city. He says, he says, do you have any arms? I'm running away from Shaul. I need to be armed. I need to protect myself. He said, I was in a bit of a rush when I was jumping out the window when the king was coming around the front door, so I didn't have a chance to check into the armory. So do you have anything that you could help me with? You know what? Do you remember when you finished this battle that you actually took the sword of Goliath and you put it over here? Where did he put it? In Nov Ir HaKohanim. He took the sword, which is almost the victory, you know, symbol of that battle, and he put it in Nov Ir HaKohanim, which was the center place for priestly service of Hashem at this time. And you hid it over here, but he actually put it behind the ephod, which means to say that when people will come to the Mishkan, or not the Mishkan, but the remnants of the Mishkan, which were in Nov, they would see this and they'd be reminded of this incredible incident. He says, they don't make swords like this anymore. David, he says, you're right, you know, this is actually a pretty good make. And David HaMelech takes it. Isn't it interesting that at the end of the day, David HaMelech does take the sword of Goliath in his pursuit of Shaul? There's something interesting which is going on over here in terms of the dynamics of power. You see something interesting. David HaMelech, when he's trying to prove a point as to how power is wielded, he says, you know what, I'm not taking a sword. I'm only going to use it upon my enemies who think it's powerful. I mean, I'm going to kill them first, and then I'm going to pull it out and use it as the final blow on the people who think it's so powerful, but I'm going to kill them first without power. That's the way David HaMelech utilizes it. And I'm going to place it in Nov Ir Kohanim, and everybody who's going to come serve God is going to see that power is not vested in instruments of war, in high-grade weaponry. That's the lesson they're going to be learn. But when I need to, sometimes there's a time when you need to pick up the sword again. When Shaul HaMelech is using that as the power against David HaMelech, needs to pull it out. The way it is said in Oz Melech is very, very powerful over here in the source 9. We're just going to do the second paragraph. He says, "V'kein sikem David is darkoi zois behimnon bitchonoi b'hagadol b'Hashem." This is what he says when he says in Tehillim, Cherev pischu pischei rushaim v'darkei kishtam lahapil oni ve'vyam. The sword of the evil is intent upon those who are poor and impoverished, those who are not powerful. Levtoach yishrei derech. Nitboach yishrei derech. To kill those, to butcher those who are of straight path. V'charbom tovoi b'libom v'kashtoi som t'shaberna. Their swords will come back to their own hearts, and their bows will be broken. The way David uses arms is to kill the bearers of it themselves. You, Goliath, wanted to use this against me. I'm going to use it to cut your own head off after I prove that God is all powerful. And he quotes there's a famous Gemara which says, Mine, in the previous paragraph, which he says, just the Aramaic words, Mine uve of Aboshade be Nargo. The axe handle comes from the forest it cut down. Right? You are the power, Goliath, but I'm going to use your own power against you. Hanizachona Shalem Yitzmatza, Besheivas Koichoi Umibatoi, Shelahayev, Verechishasom Lecha. He turns all the power back on Goliath himself. It doesn't find expression just in taking his sword. He takes all the arms of Goliath and he brings it back to his tent, as we saw at the end, because everything you cherished as power, I'm going to use as an indicator that this power is in fact not powerful. And that's the point of David Melech's final stop over here. We're not going to have a time this evening, but what I would say is that it is worthwhile to take a read through. I included this on page 13, Tehillim Chof Beis, because Tehillim Chof Beis, in fact, does talk about this incident itself. There are references to how David HaMelech felt as he stood in front of Goliath, and to see his emotions as he looked at this battle and the terror that he experienced, and at the same time how he was able to come through and express his victory to those people who always were naysayers to him. And his brothers, he talks about, who said he couldn't. And this gives us a little bit of an inkling into an interplay between where Tehillim and where Tanakh are talking about two different worlds. Tanakh is the world that David faces on the outside, and Tehillim is the world that David expresses on the inside. And how the two work with each other. It's very fascinating to put all the different emotions, the kaleidoscope of emotions, back into David as he actually walks out to this Philistine. But I leave that to you in your good time. I thank you very, very much, and look forward to continue after a wonderful summer in the next step of Shmuel. Thank you so much, ladies.
Thank you.